History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We've learned they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to ask a few questions and then listen patiently enough for long-buried memories to take on some new meaning in the here and now. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. What a story we are in for today. Bridgeport, California has a posted population of 553. And the story of survival we're going to hear from 97-year-old Richard Burbine has enough mind-blowing material for all 553 and then some. He first served our country as a teenager, and 80 years later, he's still finding unique ways to serve. So I've interviewed quite a few guys who say, once a Marine, always a Marine, but I can't remember if I've ever met someone who was in the Merchant Marine before he became a Marine, and I want to take you back even further than that. Take me back to the very beginning, because you've got quite an interesting life's journey here.
Yeah. I started in 1926. My father was in World War I. He got mustard gas, and he died when I was 2 years old. My mother was a surgical nurse. She couldn't support us and work at the same time, so they sent us to Canada with my grandparents, Yarmouth, Nova Scotia. And I stayed there until 1938, when England and Canada went to war with the Germans. And I came back to the United States at that time. The first thing I wanted to do in 1942, when I was old enough, 16 years old, I joined the Merchant Marine. I tried to join the Marine Corps at that time, but I was colorblind, and they sent me down the hall, and they said, the Navy will take anybody. So consequently, I went in when I was 16 years old. I served all over the world in World War II, from the South Pacific to Japan to all the way to Russia and back. I was torpedoed on February 23rd, 1945, coming back from Murmansk, Russia. I am the last survivor of the last American ship sunk in World War II.
And we want to hear all about that. I'm interested, too, in your childhood, because you've told your story before. You've lived with it your whole life. It may not seem that significant. You just told us your father died when you were two, so you never really knew him. You're raised by your grandparents. Do you remember as a boy having some ideas of, hey, someday here's what I'm going to do with my life. This is what I want to be or what I want to do?
When I was in Canada, 90% of the people there were fishermen or sea captains. My granddad was a sea captain, and I became interested in going to sea at that time when I was a young child. And I always had fond memories because every time we went to the big city of Yarmouth, he took me down to the fishing schooners, and he knew all the fishing captains and all that. So it was instilled in me as a young child that the seaman life was the way to go, and consequently, I followed that idea.
And I know to live here in Bridgeport, California at 6,500 feet, you have to be able to tolerate some cold weather a little bit, but I want some perspective on this. Growing up in Nova Scotia, what kind of temperatures or conditions were you dealing with?
We dealt with snow 6 months of the year. Cold weather, 40 below zero at times. We had what you might call typhoon-type weather. Storms, rain, heavy snows, and blizzard conditions from days at a time. And consequently, I've grown up that way, and it didn't bother me. I'm here in Bridgeport now at 42, 45 below zero. It's another sunny day.
Well, and we're going to hear something maybe even more challenging than that by the time we're done. Another thing I'm interested in, and maybe there's something leading up to this, because you told us you wanted to sign up for the Marine Corps at 16, but you would have been, I guess, 15 when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. And most guys I talk to have some kind of memory of that day. Do you remember December 7th, 41?
My brother and I were in the movie theater when it was announced that Japan had attacked the United States. And as soon as we got out of the theater, we said, we're going to join. At that time, I was just coming under 16 years old. And I made a vow to myself that when I was 16 years old, I was going to go and fight those bastards. So consequently, my mother, I told her, whether you sign for me or not, I'm going to go. I'll get somebody to sign for me. And I did. So she volunteered to sign for me, and I went in to the Marine Corps, and they said, no, we can't use you because you're colorblind. But go down the hall. They'll be glad to get to the Navy. They'll be glad to get anybody. They're looking for bodies. And I did. I joined the Naval Reserve Merchant Marine, and that was in 1942.
Yeah, and as you said, you know, you went all over the world, and I want to hear about some of those adventures. But can you take us back to that 16-year-old kid and remember what your expectations were, what you really thought you were getting into?
My expectations were exactly what it turned out to be. I wanted to get in the fight as soon as possible, and I did. I went from boot camp right to the Pacific and went and joined a troop ship. We took troops to New Guinea, all through the Solomon Islands and New Guinea, made three landings in New Guinea. And then we came back to the United States. I joined a ship that was an ammunition ship. And we went to North Africa, and from there on out, all over the world. And consequently, ended up in Murmansk. First ship was the Sea Marlin. We transported Army troops to New Guinea and through the Solomon Islands. It's what they call the Bismarck Sea War.
And, you know, now with the lens of history, we know that being in the Merchant Marine was about the most dangerous thing you could do in World War II, as far as the casualties and the chances of survival. Did you have any idea about that risk that you were taking at the time?
I did, because I figured they won't take me in the Army or the Navy or the Marine Corps, and I wasn't about to go in the Army, that I would take the chances, and I did, and I survived.
And what were your duties aboard ship?
I was with the engine utility. We took care of all the pumps and the generators and the small machinery. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The boilers and all that. And when we come in port, we'd pull the headers off the boilers, lance the tubes, and put new gaskets in on the steam drums and all that. That was a part of our duty.
How'd you get along with the other guys on the ship?
Never had a problem. All the years I went, I never had a bad word or a problem with any of them. They were great people, and they all took the same chances as I did. We were all in the same boat, and that was it. Good people.
So you told us, you know, a cargo ship, and then an ammunition ship, and those two seem a little different. I mean, does it cross your mind that if you're on an ammunition ship and there's a submarine, that there could be a big boom somewhere?
The only thing that was a joke amongst ourselves, if we ever got hit, we'd never hear the explosion. It was that quick on an ammunition ship. So we took it for granted that, hey, if it happened, you'd never know it. And that's the way we all felt.
And for people who may not follow, you're saying the speed of sound isn't fast enough to catch up with what's already happened to you.
With the explosion, yeah. By the time you heard the explosion, you're gone. That would be the end of it. The lights were out.
And I understand. I mean, you can joke about some of these things now, but at the time, did you think you might not make it home, that you might not see your mother or your family again?
Never even crossed my mind. We took it for granted that we were there, and whatever happened, happened. And that's the way it was. You didn't dwell on things like that back in those days.
Well, and when you mentioned the troop ship, right, and taking all these young teenage faces just like yours and leaving them on beachheads, and you know what's going to happen to a lot of them. Was there some gravity to that? Did that weigh on you?
It was a thought that was behind your mind, really. You didn't dwell on it because you knew that it was going to happen, but you didn't know who it was going to happen to. And it was a known fact, and you just took it as a matter of policy or fact. Death was going to happen.
Well, and I know we're going to hear about February of 1945 and what happened, and people are going to be amazed that you survived that, let alone you're still going so strong now. But I'm just guessing that if you were in for that long a period, that there were probably some close calls or some hair-raising moments, some things that got your attention before the sinking of your ship in 45.
On several different convoys, ships would disappear from one area to another. The ships were in lanes, and every now and then you'd hear an explosion, you'd look in there, well, it was nothing but a cloud of smoke and dust, and that was the end of it. We couldn't stop because our orders were you don't stop, because you're in danger of the whole convoy when you do. But they had ships on the side, Navy ships, escorting us. They would stop and pick up the survivors or whatever who was left of the crews. And that happened on several times. But other than that, you didn't dwell on those things. You had a job to do, and you did it, and that was all there was to it.
And what can you tell us about the submarine threat, whether German or Japanese, and how big a presence that was in your thought process, your awareness, your consciousness?
We didn't think about it. If you thought about it, you'd go crazy. So it was a thought that you just put behind your mind, and you just dwelled on what you were doing and what was happening on the ship. And that's the way it was. You just didn't sit there and dwell on anything like that because you knew it was going to happen, but you didn't know when or where or who. And that's the way it was.
Did you ever hear from home?
Well, whenever we came back in port, we didn't get any mail or anything of that nature while we were at sea. They didn't even know where we were going, let alone where to send mail. So consequently, most of our mail was received on return to the United States.
So much has been written and told about World War II, but there are still areas of it that most people are not familiar with. I think if you ask the casual, you know, observer, they'll say, hey, there was the Pacific Theater and the Atlantic. They might not know about China, Burma, and India. And in this country, we don't know a whole lot about what was going on in Russia. But you mentioned Murmansk. What were you guys doing way up there?
Well, during World War II, you got to remember, the Russians were our allies. They were a strong ally because they took care of all that northern districts, which eliminated the American troops from even participating in there. Murmansk was really devastated. The Germans would come over there on a daily basis and strafe the whole harbor and everything in town. The people were absolutely destitute. What we did was every time the Germans would come over almost on a daily basis, on a time base, every ship in the harbor would open fire on them, strafe the whole area. So consequently, after the war, the Russians awarded us their highest medal for fighting and serving the motherland, which is unheard of here in the United States because most people never heard of it. There's two of us here in California, myself and another individual, and I can't think of his name, have the highest medal that the Russians gave to the American people, and it's right there, the medal of Ustyugov. And he was an admiral in the Russian Navy that never lost a battle. And consequently, after the war was over, they awarded us that medal for that reason, because we fought for the motherland.
I see it, yeah, and that's a first for me. I've interviewed over 1,000 guys from World War II, and I've never seen one of those in person, so this is exciting to see, and I want to hear the story. But before we hear about February 23rd, how long had you guys been operating in those waters?
Well, it wasn't so much operating in those waters. It was the fact that we went to Murmansk, and then from Murmansk we shuttled up to Archangel. And those were the only two ports in Russia that we went to. The reason for that was that they had the facilities in one port that was not available in the other for lifting off heavy equipment, locomotives. We had locomotives on deck, heavy ammunition, and that's why we went between the two, shuttle between the two ports. That was the only service we did while we were in Russia, was go from one port to the other and discharge our cargo, which was ammunition, locomotives, and tanks.
So you'd been in the tropical waters of the Pacific, where you're probably just walking around with no shirt and shorts, I'm guessing, right?
That's for sure, yeah. I went all through the Pacific area, from New Guinea down to the Solomons of the Philippines. Survived that. Another lucky break. It wasn't my time to go, and that's the way it was.
Were there some moments like that in the Pacific that almost got you?
There was a few, yes, in New Guinea and New Hebrides, all through that area. We got strafed by the Japanese. Consequently, we just survived, and it wasn't our time to go. And that's the way it was.
On a merchant ship, if you do find yourself under attack, was there something you were supposed to do in those moments?
Each and every one of us had a gun tub and a gun position that we were, and that's what we did. We either fired the weapons, and if the gun crew, Navy gun crew, any one of our people got killed, we took over for them, loading and firing their weapons.
And a lot of people don't understand this, that on these merchant ships, they had a whole lot of crewmen that were part of the merchant marine, but you also had Navy personnel on the same ship, as you said, doing the same job if you filled in, but were treated very, very differently by the government, weren't they?
They were treated as Navy personnel, which they were, and rightly so. They were gunners, and that's what their trade was, were gunners. We were seamen that operated the ship and not the guns. The only time we had anything to do with the weapons was our fire station. When we had a general alarm, we went to our firing station, which were gun tubs 1, 2, 3, or 4, whatever it might be. And you served as a loader. In the event the gunner got killed, you took over the weapon, loading and shooting the weapon. And that's the way it was.
But as I understand it, right, and I just want our listeners to understand, those Navy guys had full government benefits, full veteran status. You guys had none of that. You could be in the same battle. Navy guy gets wounded. He gets a Purple Heart. You get wounded. You get nothing.
That's true. That's absolutely true. In fact, after the war, almost 40 years after the war was over, I got my Mariner's Medal for being wounded during World War II.
But they've never given you the Purple Heart.
And they still will not give us a Purple Heart. Although they gave us veteran status, they will not give us a Purple Heart. The only thing that we have received from the American government was about 6 months ago. We were given the Congressional Gold Medal.
And I want to talk to you about that and what that meant. With respect to the Purple Heart, does that bother you at all that guys in your situation don't get what the other guys on the same ship or the same circumstances receive?
No, I was awarded the Mariner's Medal, which in our viewpoint is the same. It is the same as the Purple Heart. The only difference is the name. And I feel that the American government more or less gave us a slap in the face. They said we were willing to die for the country, but they weren't willing enough to give us a Purple Heart, which we earned.
And the Purple Heart comes with benefits for a lifetime through the VA, too. I know we're bouncing around here. The reason I brought up the weather in the Pacific and how hot in these tropical waters, and if you're down below by the boiler, I mean, you're probably 140 degrees, so you're out on the deck enjoying the sunshine. But to go from that to the waters off Murmansk, I mean, that's quite a contrast there.
Well, you'd be down in the fire room or engine room, which I was all the time. I spent all my time below the sea line. It was 130, 135, 140 degrees. And you come up on deck, and it was 20 below. It was an instantaneous freeze. It was just like somebody hit you with a belt. It was a shock to the body as soon as you stepped out onto the deck because it was so cold from that variation of heat and cold.
And I know how imaginative and ingenious young men can be. Were there some things that you guys on the crew came up with to mitigate those factors at all, to make it easier to deal with that transition?
No, that didn't happen. We were crew, and the officers made all the decisions as to what was going to be done and what was not going to be done. And they followed regulations strictly, and that's the way it was. We just did our job.
And I'm just, you know, just imagining, if it's that cold, nobody wants to end up in the water.
That's the last thing you want to do is end up in the water, because it was almost instantaneous freeze. You could be in the water for 4 to 5 minutes, and you were to the point where you were almost immobile from the cold. When we got torpedoed, I was in the water for 3.5, almost 4 hours. When they picked us up, I was the first one in the water and the last one to be picked up. The veins in our body were coming through the skin of the skin or flesh, like crystal bottles that froze, and it was crystallized all over our body. And the doctor, when he came aboard, said we had another minute or so, and we'd have absolutely froze to death. That's how close we were.
You know, I don't want to leave anything out that's important to you, but maybe we can hear about that day from start to finish. And as we lead up to it, let me ask you this. Before that day, before your ship was sunk, had there been other times where you guys had come under attack by German aircraft?
You got to remember, back in those days, from Norway to Russia was a daily operational for KG-26. They were from Germany into Norway. And when they captured Norway, they set up a base for convoy destroyers, and they flew from Norway to Murmansk back and forth. That was their steady patrol. So you were under that type of attacks every day, and the numbers were odd or even. It was either your time or it wasn't, and that's what happened.
And we're going to hear about that fateful day in the Barents Sea from start to finish when we come back. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for a short video with 97-year-old Dick Burbine of Bridgeport, California. And we'll be right back after this.